This season of The Francis Effect is sponsored in part by Franciscan Media, seeking to spread the gospel in the spirit of St. Francis. Franciscan Media publishes books by authors like Richard Rohr, Heather King, and Ronald Rollheiser. Get 25% off your first order in the store when you use the code FrancisFX, that's Francis, the letter F and the letter X, at franciscanmedia.org. That's franciscanmedia.org. This season of The Francis Effect is brought to you by Liturgical Press in Collegeville, Minnesota. Liturgical Press is a trusted publisher of resources on liturgy, scripture, theology, and spirituality, evolving to serve the changing needs of the Christian church. They produce resources for pastoral leaders, teachers, engaged learners, and all readers looking for quality books on faith and culture. Lit Press books are available at your favorite book retailer and online at litpress.org. That's litpress.org. Hello, and welcome to the Francis Effect Podcast. My name is David Dalt. I host a radio show called Things Not Seen about culture and faith, and I'm an assistant professor of Christian spirituality at the Institute of Pastoral Studies at Loyola University Chicago. I'm here with my friends Heidi Schlumpf and Father Dan Horan. Heidi is senior correspondent at National Catholic Reporter, a publication that connects Catholics to church, faith, and the common good with independent news, analysis, and spiritual reflection. Father Dan is professor of philosophy, religious studies, and theology, and director of the Center for the Study of Spirituality at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. He is also affiliated professor of spirituality at the Oblate School of Theology in San Antonio, Texas. Every couple of weeks, we get together to discuss news and events through a lens of our shared Catholic faith. Father Dan and Heidi, welcome to you both. Heidi, how have you been?
I'm great. What's so weird? Because we're recording 2 weeks in a row, right? To play catch up for the episode that we missed while Dan and I were in Italy. And so this is the second time we've been recording since I've been back from Italy. And I still have jet lag. Isn't that
like
some people don't get it at all. And I'm still waking up at 5-6 in the morning. So it didn't help that there was daylight savings this weekend. But otherwise, I'm doing well and I'm open to any listeners' suggestions about how to better get over jet lag quickly. And I'm about to get on a plane again next week. Shout out to the folks at the University of Seattle, and I'm excited to be giving a lecture there next Tuesday. I know it's going to compete with something that's at St. Mary's as well, but it's the Fall Catholic Heritage Lecture and the 2023 Anne O'Hara Graff Lecture, which I'm excited to be doing something named after her. So it's going to be at 4 p.m. Seattle time on Tuesday, and I'm going to be talking about, did the church listen to women and LGBTQ Catholics at the Synod? And of course, later in the show, we'll hear from Jim Martin about that as well. Also, just wanted to give a shout out to those Chicago Benedictine sisters. I went to the funeral of Sister Patsy Crowley over the weekend. And for people who don't know her, she's very prominent here in Chicago, a leader with a ministry to homeless women and to refugees towards the end of her life, but also came from this sort of famous Catholic family, the Crowleys, who had been one of the married couples that was consulted for the birth control commission back in the 60s. So my colleague, Bob McClory, wrote a book about her parents, so a famous family, but it was just a beautiful liturgy. She was an amazing woman, and so I was grateful to be able to be at that funeral. So Dan, tell us about the conflicting talk that's going to be at the exact same time as mine in Seattle.
Yeah, well, there's always a lot of great stuff going on, and it's an abundance of good things. So the Center for the Study of Spirituality here at St. Mary's College, we're hosting Sister Ilia Delio of Villanova University, who also happens to be a dear friend of mine and my master's thesis director. We go way back. And so she'll be coming here to speak about Thomas Merton and Teilhard de Chardin, looking at spirituality in particular. And that's taking place on Tuesday, November 14th at 7 p.m. Eastern time. If you go to stmarys.edu/spirituality and check out our events page, you can find a link for the free live stream. And if you're in the greater Michiana, Chicago, Indianapolis area and you want to come to the campus, it is free and open to the public. The live stream is free as well. We'd be very happy to have you here. And so it should be a great lecture. Those who know Sister Ilya's work, know what a great theologian she is, always tease her about the fact that she's too smart. She's one of those rare academics who has two PhDs, a PhD in science from Rutgers University and a PhD in historical theology from Fordham. So it's going to be a blast. So we invite everybody to check that out. If you're not checking out Heidi's, I don't know if yours is being live streamed.
I think it is and recorded. Oh, okay. So people can find ways to do both.
Exactly. So I'm actually, after we record this, we're recording on Tuesday. I teach here at St. Mary's in the afternoon, and then I'm getting right on the road to head to Cleveland, Ohio. So by the time this episode drops, I'll be returning, God willing, back to Indiana, but I'm giving the annual Abrahamic lecture at Notre Dame College in just outside Cleveland. I'm delighted to do that. And so a preemptive shout out and note of gratitude. Hopefully it all works out well, but I'm very excited about that. I'm going to be talking about theologies of creation and human personhood. So it should be a lot of fun. Speaking of lectures, teaching, events, traveling, Zooming, David, how the heck are you?
I'm doing well. I am still working on revision, and also new writing. So I'm working very slowly on the revisions of the Accessorized Bible. I know that I have promised this book not only to listeners, but also to my editors at Yale many times now, but I do see the end in sight. In fact, today, before we began recording, I was working on the third chapter revision, and it's coming very well. The conclusion is done. The second chapter is solid. I feel really good about how the book is singing in a kind of ethical note structure. And so that is really the spine of the whole book. And so everything else is getting revised with these key chapters in place. And so everything else, I hope, will be much simpler once these three are done. And I have just contributed a chapter to a volume on mental illness in academia. And I'm also working on a collected chapter for the Associated Graduate Programs in Ministry. Several scholars from that organization are putting together a volume on synodality. And I'm contributing a chapter to that, which I'm very excited about. So all that is coming. And it's all good. But in the midst of that, I'm also being a father, and we had a great Halloween where our two kids made their own costumes and went out trick-or-treating. I'm really enjoying teaching. The students are fantastic, and I'm still recovering from having COVID. So all that is what's going on.
Between the extended jet lag of Heidi and your medium term, if not truly long COVID, medium COVID has, I'm so sorry for both of you, but David especially, you've been carrying that for a while. I will say, all you're talking about the books, my publisher will kill me because I forgot to mention that the day, I think it's the day that this drops, if not Friday, the next day, is the official publication date of my latest book, Engaging Thomas Merton, Spirituality, Justice, and Racism, published by Orbis Books. Very excited about that. Apparently not excited enough to remember to plug it on our own podcast. I'll blame my Franciscan humility for not promoting my book enough. But do check that out, and I'm sure we'll have a link in there. And David, I have been one of these people, maybe second to your editor, who I'm sure is very eager and has been to receive your final manuscript. I'm looking forward to your book as well. Here's a question. Are you going to the AAR this year by any chance?
I will be at the American Academy of Religion from Saturday to Tuesday morning, flying back hopefully in time to record our next episode. So that is absolutely happening. If you are going to be in San Antonio and you want to see me, dear listeners, look for me in the shadows in the corners, because that's where I tend to lurk at places like this. But Dan, are you going to be there?
I will be there. I have a lot of meetings, both publishing meetings, but also editorial board meetings. And then I'm moderating one of the sessions on Saturday morning. So I'm sure we will connect. One of the things listeners may recall over the years, this is, those who know the LA Religious Ed Congress, this is like that for scholars and scholars of religion. And it is massive. There's 7,000 to 10,000 scholars of religion and of scripture of all kinds of religious backgrounds that come to this. It's always the weekend before Thanksgiving. It is both the best of times and the worst of times, but the best of times includes getting to see dear friends in person. David, I'm looking forward to we'll connect there, but also so many others. And it includes like almost every religion department, every major university, and every publisher putting on receptions. And so you see a lot of your friends as you're hopping from one social gathering to another in the evening. So work hard by day, presenting research and scholarship, party hard at night with friends and colleagues. You get very little sleep. I often say you sleep too little, you drink too much, both of coffee and of adult beverages. So Yeah, looking forward to that, David. I'll see you in Texas.
Likewise.
I have only ever been to AAR once, and I do hope to get back, although I have to tell you, I was a bit overwhelmed as a journalist trying to focus on Catholic stories, but there were just so many other interesting religion panels and topics there. Next time we get together to record, I'm going to have to remember to bring my equipment with me too, because I'm going to be in Philadelphia that week of Thanksgiving when we'll be recording. And hopefully I'll be over my jet lag by then.
I don't know. Heading to the West Coast and then back to the East Coast. You might still be...
Yeah. I know. I'm starting to feel like Dan, except you don't get jet lag this way. So
not really. No. My secret, you asked about the secrets. I think I told you this when we met up in Italy. For me, it's all about the meals. But as somebody reminded me, you have to be a regular diner at the same time. So I roughly have breakfast first thing in the morning, something to eat roughly midday, lunch, and then dinner at a reasonable hour. It's always Italy that throws me off because they have dinner at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And my body has that and says, oh, you're going to be awake for another 4 or 5 hours. And so I can't sleep. But usually that helps me with jet lag across the world. And knock on wood, it keeps working. So yeah, I don't know if that's helpful to you or listeners, but that's
my secret. I did do it on the way back. But the good news is, at this time of day, I'm already awake, so I'm raring to go.
That's good.
Well, listeners, we've been talking a lot about what's coming up for us in the next few weeks, but let's talk about what's coming up on the show. So in our first segment today, we're going to be looking at, you know, former President Donald Trump has been indicted and has had civil suits coming against him, but it's just been very recently that he's taken the stand and has actually testified on his own behalf. So we're going to be digging into that in our first segment. In our second segment, we're going to be looking at the recent election of Mike Johnson to the position of Speaker of the House, looking at who he is and what that might mean, particularly given his very strong religious bent and his public statements about not believing in the separation of church and state. And then on our third segment, Heidi has a conversation with Father James Martin, a well-known Jesuit and friend of the podcast. So all that's coming up on The Francis Effect. Please stay with us. Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm David Dalt, and I'm here with Father Dan Horan and Heidi Schlumpf. Every couple of weeks, we get together to discuss a variety of topics from a perspective informed by our Catholic faith. Earlier this week, former President Donald Trump took the stand in a New York courtroom to testify in a civil trial resulting from a lawsuit filed by the New York Attorney General Letitia James, which accuses Trump and his co-defendants, including at least two of his children, Donald Jr. and Eric, of inflating the value of their company's assets in order to acquire better rates on loans and insurance plans. A little more than a month ago, the judge in the case, Arthur F. Engeron, ruled that Trump and his co-defendants were, in fact, liable for fraud based on the facts of the case. The current trial, which in this case does not include a jury but is argued before the judge, is intended to decide what the punishment is for Trump, his co-defendants, and the Trump Organization. Attorney General James has asked that Trump pay $250 million and that he and his sons be permanently barred from running a business in the state of New York. Earlier in the trial, both Donald Jr. and Eric testified under oath, but Monday marked a historical moment when, for the first time in nearly a century, a former U.S. president testified in court. The last time was in 1913, when former President Theodore Roosevelt testified in a libel case. Despite this unusual circumstance, one thing did play out predictably. Donald Trump, even under oath, lashed out frequently in what the New York Times described as, quote, voluble, even explosive, off-the-cuff speech, unquote. The Times also reports that the judge had difficulty reining Trump in, and even ordered Trump's attorneys to get their client under control. The judge also warned Trump that the courtroom was not a political rally and that he needed to respond succinctly and directly to the questions posed by the prosecution and even his own lawyers during cross-examination. Trump, and later his attorneys, had been placed under gag orders by the court after repeatedly attacking the judge's clerk, the attorney general, and several witnesses on social media and during campaign rallies. In addition to this civil trial, Trump is facing the prospect of 3 criminal trials in the coming months related to his alleged illegal activities in Washington and Georgia to steal the 2020 presidential election, as well as his alleged role in the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol. He's charged in 91 felony counts in those cases. Dan, like the rest of us, you've been following this developing story. What do you make of the events this week?
Well, you can't make this stuff up, which is, I feel like, the responsorial psalm when it comes to the Trump scripture, to make a very messy analogy here. The first thing is, it's very stupid of him, first and foremost, that he's antagonizing the one person who has all the power in this trial. As you mentioned, David, there is no jury. This is not, first of all, a criminal trial. And it's also something that, in terms of his liability and the liability of the Trump organization, had been determined in a court of law. The judge had already ruled that the evidence was sufficient and that fraud has been committed and that there is responsibility here. What's interesting is that now the role of this trial, as you said, is to determine what the penalties are. And the person who makes that decision is this judge that Trump keeps antagonizing. So first and foremost, it makes no sense. I can't quite figure out what the strategy is here. The second thing is, you know, that there's only going to be stakes that are higher, right? So this is a civil lawsuit. This is not a criminal trial, as we keep saying. While there will be financial and possibly long-term business implications and penalties that arise from this, he still is facing 91 felony counts and 3 other cases of indictment at the federal and state level. And so I don't know what to make of this. I feel like in the 2016 campaign, Trump said, we're winning so much, people are going to be tired of winning. And I think what I've become tired of is the new precedents that keep surfacing. We always say this has never happened before. In truth, the last time, as you mentioned, that a former president was put under oath in a courtroom was Teddy Roosevelt in 1913 in a libel case. But Teddy Roosevelt did not act this way. And so in this regard, Trump, again, is an exception to almost every rule. One thing I'll just flag, and I'll be curious to see what the two of you think, is that in this past week, the New York Times with Siena College has published some really startling polling data that shows that in the key battleground states, Trump is actually doing better than Joe Biden. And part of that has to do, at least as the data has been analyzed, is with concerns about Joe Biden's age and fittingness and this sort of thing. Curiously, compared to the 2019 poll done by the same organizations, Trump is actually losing popularity. So it's not that he's getting stronger, it's just that Joe Biden is getting weaker. And one of the key tipping points that also surfaced is that if Trump were convicted of crimes, that would have some impact even on those who currently support him or are suggesting that they might vote for him a year from now. I feel like with Trump, there's a lot of Teflon here and nothing has ever really stuck. I have flashbacks to 2016 and the Access Hollywood tape just weeks beforehand. There are a lot of things that can skew public opinion and outcomes. But even if Trump's convicted on 91 felony counts, I don't know what to expect. I don't think this is going to make much of a difference for people who are interested in supporting him. What do you two think about this?
Well, I also was going to bring up that polling data because while that was released, I think, Saturday night or Sunday, so obviously the people who were polled had not seen his performance on Monday in terms of some of the craziness that you're talking about. I mean, it almost is entertaining if it weren't so serious, right, to see him up there with either no strategy or a strategy that just says, I'm going to do whatever I want and see if I can still get out of this or still become president. So that polling data, yeah, I did see that like caveat that if he were convicted, some 6% or something of Republicans said they would vote for Biden. And I think that the reason so many Democrats and lovers of democracy, I guess, were so concerned about the numbers is that it really did hone in on those key states. We've talked before about how in the end, elections are not won by the overall popular vote in this country, and certain states have a very outsized influence on who becomes president. And so this was looking specifically at those states and how Joe Biden was losing influence there and polling share, and particularly losing among voters of color. So normally, something that's considered sort of a stronghold of the Democratic Party, both Latino voters or African-American voters, and concerns about how that will play out. I will just note, we're recording this on Tuesday. It's election day in some states. So I know I'm following what's going on in Ohio, in Kentucky, Virginia, I'm trying to think where else, but certainly I've seen some commentators already say not to make too much of what happens with these particular elections today. But to me, that sounds like people are expecting that their side might be losing and they don't want it to mean too much. So yeah, a lot to follow here. The trial, very, very concerning to see how a former president is talking.
Well, and I want to note, there have not been cameras or recording devices in this courtroom. So a lot of what we're getting are coming from those that have been present in the courtroom, then reporting about the ways in which Trump's behavior and some of the things Trump has said have unfolded. And so for those that have not been paying close attention, I just want to give a quick overview of some of the tenor and character of Trump's remarks. Speaking about the testimony that happened on Monday, the day before we are recording this, there was a certain point where Donald Trump was mumbling and refusing to answer audibly. There was another case where he pulled out a piece of paper, insisting that he was going to read a statement instead of answering questions. And then when he was asked by the judge and when his lawyers were asked by the judge to help keep former President Trump focused on answering the questions that were being asked, which is the procedure in a court of law, there's a point where reportedly Donald Trump began to lash out and yell at the judge, saying that the trial was unfair, that none of the objections ever broke Trump's way. I can't think of a greater example than this of the contempt that this individual and those that associate closely with him has for the rule of law and the notion of the kind of democratic practices and proprieties upon which we make decisions that don't lead to violence or that are not based in violence. There's that great enlightenment thing that we're going to talk our way to a better world, or we're going to kill our way to a different world. And I think this is an example of the kind of weight that Trump puts on the latter, not on the former. He wants to be a bully, and he seems to want to flout all of the things that we have achieved under so much time and struggle to get to nonviolent solutions to our society's problems and the way that we make decisions together.
Yeah, that paper you referenced that he wanted read into the record allegedly had something to do with it. It was some clause that he claims to have included in his reporting on valuation of assets. And basically, it's been described in some media reports as a do not trust this information clause, which in and of itself is insane. The other thing is, it's just another instance of somebody who is a grifter and a fraudster. The fact that he's gotten away for so long with making stuff up, this kind of shiny object distraction kind of stuff, is just quite striking. It really does do damage for those who have eyes to see and ears to hear to any kind of presentation that he's a good business person. One thing that's come up in this trial is like he himself has made reference back to what a Forbes magazine article said some years back about his alleged net worth. And apparently at some business meetings, he's presented this as evidence to back him up. The funny thing is, or maybe not so funny, but the sad thing perhaps, is that was a self-reported assessment, right? So Forbes is not a regulator. Forbes is not the SEC or something like this. They're just basing their information on the information they get from assumed reliable sources. So it's a circular sort of loop of reasoning, and it's an illogical sense of reasoning too. So it, just to build on what you were saying, David, I just think it's another illustration not only of his contempt for the rule of law and his feeling like he's exempt from that, but I think it's also being caught and realizing actually he can't get away with all these things. He knows what he's doing because there have been instances in the past where he's been under oath in depositions where there are real stakes and he complies. And this, I don't know what's going on. Maybe he's tipped over the edge out of reality.
The other thing that's been reported is that apparently he or some of his buddies have talked about what they would do at the beginning of a second Trump term. And this reference to using the Insurrectionist Act to quell any protests that might happen in the aftermath of a possible second Trump presidency. And so this, what you were talking about, David, with the rule of law, I think has many people nervous, if we weren't nervous already. And what I've noticed is a number of more Democratic folks then pushing the idea of this next presidential election is going to be about democracy. And I think this is also maybe a strategy on the Dems' part in reaction to that poll data that said, when you look at Biden's age, when you look at the economy, even though all the facts say that Biden has been good for the economy, but people's perception is that he's doing poorly on the economy. And so maybe there's some sort of pivot to talking about democracy. And it does seem that's a fair issue to consider when we're looking at the next presidential election.
I feel very worried, just to state the obvious, maybe to understate the obvious. I just don't understand. I mean, I'm worried with regard to both candidates. Joe Biden, in my estimation, is an extremely better candidate. But I think I've become more worried, not my own personal concerns about his capacity at this age and the demands of the office, which a lot of people have been talking about for a while. But I'm more concerned about people's perception of that characteristic of his state in life. And this polling data really shows that that's an issue. I'm also deeply concerned to state the obvious yet again, that Trump has any support still. One of the things too that came up in that polling data that Heidi and I have been talking about is that there's this perception that Joe Biden has somehow benefited from Hunter Biden's alleged dealings, business dealings and so forth, when there's zero evidence. The Justice Department, other reporters, investigations have made clear there's nothing to back that up other than right-wing sort of commentators who have been stirring this up and conspiracy theorists who have suggested as much. But the fact that has embedded itself in people's thinking is also deeply troubling. We are really in a beyond truth age.
Well, and I just want to draw a parallel here. So when we look at Trump's behavior in the public sphere, a lot of commentators have noted that it's really aimed at the erosion of trust in our kind of democratic institutions and the structures by which we make decisions and that we have what we might call civil society. The parallel that I want to draw is to figures in the church like Archbishop Vigano and others who are, and beyond Vigano, the set of vacantists who say that there is no legitimate papacy going on right now. You can find different levels of those that are trying to erode trust in the structures of church and church governance. And what do we do when those structures have been eroded? When we can't talk to each other, the only thing that is left to us is to battle against each other. And for the last 350 years or more, we both in the church and in the state have been trying to avoid that as the resulting conclusion. And I share the fear that you two are talking about. But for me, the fear is, it almost goes to a Freudian level. If we can no longer govern ourselves with reason, then what is left is either authoritarianism or the blade. And I don't want either of those options, either in the church or in the state. So I'm terrified right now as well, just because a president should not, regardless of how you feel about Trump, just the nature of the office, a person should never be speaking like this in public, should never be acting like this in public, who has held that office or who was reasonably considered or seriously considered to be a participant in that office. And so I'm just looking around going, am I the only, what's happening here?
Well, to that, on that note too, it's against his own self-interest, which is also curious, right? Because what would be in his own self-interest is to just comply and keep his head down and quiet, because maybe then this judge who's going to make this decision about penalty would maybe rule slightly more in his favor. Like the Trump and the Trump organization is going to pay a hefty fine no matter what. But this judge has the ability to forbid him from having a business in the state of New York, which is where his business is based right now. And so that's existentially serious for that company.
Well, I think the three of us have all admitted our anxiety here, and we'll take a deep breath as we go to a short break. But you're listening to The Francis Effect, and we'll be back with more political discussion after a bit.
Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm Dan Horan. I'm here with Heidi Schlumpf and David Dalt. Every couple of weeks, we get together to talk about news and other events through a lens of our shared Catholic faith. On October 25th of this year, Louisiana Congressman Mike Johnson was elected Speaker of the House following more than 3 weeks of Republican disarray in the wake of the ouster of former Speaker Kevin McCarthy of California. Unlike the other Republican lawmakers who vied for the speaker position, Johnson has been a relative unknown on the national stage. Also, unlike many contenders, including McCarthy, Johnson was elected on the first ballot, with every Republican voting yes. Johnson was confirmed very quickly after the vote and then declared, quote, "the people's house is back in business," unquote. But what is that business exactly? In the days since Johnson's election, a lot of news outlets have reported, among other things, his ties to election denial and the January 6th insurrection. It has also been reported that Johnson has close ties with or have worked directly with organizations that advocate for anti-LGBTQIA legislation nationwide, and he's worked with organizations that were instrumental in the overturning of the Roe v. Wade decision last year. While the full picture of Mike Johnson and his policies is still being formed, we can begin to understand his overall view of politics with a quote from September 2022, when Johnson declared that he did not believe in the separation of church and state. He said, and I quote, "If anybody tries to convince you that your biblical beliefs or your religious viewpoint needs to be separated from public affairs, you should politely remind them to review their history, and you should not back down. The founders wanted to protect the church from an encroaching state, not the other way around," end quote. David, what should we focus on here?
Well, I think you've just hit the core of where I want to begin our discussion, and that is that Speaker Johnson has a particular view of religion and its relationship to the state. And by religion, I don't mean the abstract academic study of human beliefs, but rather a very specific flavor of a very specific evangelical or fundamentalist Christianity. To the extent that no other human belief system, no other way of arranging ethics and practices could be considered legitimate as a possible public position. So what we're looking at here is, and I don't want to be too alarmist about this, but this is a kind of fascism by another name, where it is saying, we know the best story for everyone, and we will tell that story for everyone. And whatever your particular personal experiences are, whatever your particular way of working out your life with fear and trembling has been, that is not legitimate. And so even though these are people who will oftentimes rail against ideas like the nanny state or the idea of somehow there being a tyranny at the heart of government, these are tyrannical people who want to tell you right from wrong. These are tyrannical people who want to tell you that you do not have a legitimate experience of your own life story, but rather you have to live the story that they have scripted for you. That's my initial take on what's going on right now with Mike Johnson. And the fact that he is the most serious possible candidate that they could find, and the one that was elected without any kind of resistance, that he was greased through the process, is alarming to me. So that's my initial thought, and I wonder what you two think.
Well, it is alarming about what it says about the Republican Party, and I know we have talked about that in the past, about what disarray we have there in terms of the more middle-of-the-road Republicans and what they're doing as they stand around and watch the party burn to the ground. Johnson is fascinating to me in a scary way. He really is, I think Mark Silk, the columnist, called him like an avatar of the evangelical movement, basically. He teaches at Liberty University. He's involved with the Family Research Council, all these touchstones to the basic evangelical political movement that arose in the 70s and is now in has quite a bit of power. Parenthetically, his personal life, very interesting to me too, and thought I was relatively familiar with evangelical Protestantism, but I did not know about covenant marriage, which is actually, he and his wife are married in a covenant marriage, which is apparently legal in two states where you're not allowed to get divorced, except in some very extreme circumstances. So yeah, this is an extreme person. And now he is third in line, right, for the presidency. So I think it's very concerning. I am at least glad to see that it's being discussed and that these things are being brought to the light of day about him and his connections, but it doesn't bode well. What are you thinking, Dan?
I'm very much in agreement. The more that we learn, the more kind of off-putting and frankly disturbing some of the details are. His views, the policies that both of you have talked about that he's advocated on behalf of, in his personal life, you know, on the one hand, I hesitate because I'm like, well, a right to privacy is important. But on the other hand, when you are, as you say, the third person in line to the presidency, that kind of personal scrutiny is really important. And as David, you've been emphasizing, the fact that he was elected so quickly, I think suggests that some of his own Republican caucus colleagues probably didn't know all the details about him. And certainly the Democrats probably weren't as aware either, because he was relatively unknown on the national platform. But that was intentional, is another thing that seems to have been reported lately, that he kept a low profile. And so because of that, people didn't really know what they were getting. He's, you know, he's not as bombastic as Jim Jordan, or he's not as ambitious outwardly as Kevin McCarthy. And so people said, oh, well, he seems like a mild-mannered gentleman from the South. Let's give him a try. I think there are a couple things that are very disturbing to me. One is, as has been mentioned already, his rampant anti-LGBTQ agenda, and that he has been very supportive of so-called Christian conversion therapies, and which are forms, as many states have noted, forms of abuse. I heard a recording of him talking in an interview from about a decade ago, where he was describing the fact that no one is actually gay or queer, because he said this isn't about your hair color or skin color or age or something. Those are aspects of being, but he reduces homosexuality, and I would say by extension, sexuality more broadly, to a series of acts. And he says that this is a behavior, and it's a distorted behavior. It's deeply disturbing. But then again, we have that kind of discourse in some circles in the Catholic Church, too. Even our own sexual ethics are oftentimes, at least at the magisterial level, articulated in acts-based thinking, right? It's not about the whole person. It's not about one's identity or who they are as created by God and how they exist in God's eyes, but it's about what we do. And then people become reduced to who we are. I think that's a real problem, whether one is straight or gay or queer in some other way. This is really troubling. It's troubling not because I disagree with it. It's troubling because it's factually errant. And this is a person who has a huge platform minimally and possibly has power that influences the lives and health and safety of other people.
I think what you're saying, Dan, about his relative obscurity being a benefit in terms of him getting elected so quickly, we have to go back to remembering the chaos that it was while we did not have a Speaker of the House for so many weeks. And I think that it might be that at some point, people who were not aware of his background were just grateful to get somebody through there, because it was really problematic to obviously have such broken government that we couldn't even have a speaker elected. So all of these things together, combined with our conversation of the previous segment about Trump, point to some real brokenness in our political system. That, David, with you making the connection to our church, I'm at least slightly more hopeful in our church situation, where I've always said it, we have the Holy Spirit helping us, but also at least movement in our church, where it seems like we're trying to at least bring people together so that we can talk and not have to resort to the blade, as you said.
Well, and I just want to add that when we think about these processes where a basically unvetted person is now in the line of succession to the presidency, when the advantage to the Republicans to elect Johnson was that nobody knew anything about him, and so he came to this sort of very powerful position without a lot of vetting, that just speaks to the necessity of people of moral seriousness and goodwill getting involved in the electoral process and in the structures of governance at every level. Like, we cannot be quietists. We cannot simply say we're going to just tend to our spiritual lives and tend to our church communities and stay out of politics. We have to get involved in this. And I'm saying this as much to myself as I am to listeners, that we have an obligation to try and work for the common good. And the common good doesn't simply mean the most profit for the people that we like. The common good means that those who are the least of these among us, that Matthew 25 talks about, can look at our structures of governance, can look at our civic arrangements, can look at the way that we are allocating resources and say, I am flourishing, I feel safe in this arrangement. That is the litmus test. Not what we wish, not what we intend, but what the least of these say is actually happening with them. And I can't, I'll just be honest, I can't see with the kind of agenda that is already being laid out by Speaker Johnson, I can't see the least of these flourishing. I can't see those that are under threat of violence or who are experiencing actual violence changing and saying, I now feel safe because of these policies. And that to me breaks my heart, and I hope that it would break every Catholic person's heart.
I think also there's some objective Catholic teaching that, in addition to the common good and the least of these, as you've been describing it, David, we need to keep in mind. One of which is Mike Johnson, according to reports, would qualify as a Christian nationalist who views, first of all, whose views are grounded, first of all, in a mistaken view of the origins of this country and its constitution, reads in an eisegetical matter, a kind of Christian universalism that the founding fathers were Christians, intended this to be a quote unquote Christian nation. We've heard these sorts of things before, which are factually untrue, right? Historians have made that very clear. But this idea that Christianity is the best way and should be the only way, as has been raised already, flies in the face of Catholic Church teaching. So Second Vatican Council makes it very clear that religious liberty is a fundamental human right, and that religious pluralism is not a bad thing, but a good thing. And that we are meant to be in dialogue and in interfaith, interreligious friendships with one another, that there, as the council teaches, and this is the Catholic view, that things that are good and true in other religions and cultures are not to be rejected by Catholics. So I would just say that as a fellow Christian, right, Mike Johnson is obviously not Catholic and probably has his own issues with the Catholic Church. His understanding and brand of Christianity is distinctive. But as a fellow Christian, as a fellow baptized Christian, I think I would want to say I don't agree with this worldview that you're holding, and neither should 1.2 billion Roman Catholics. I know for sure that Pope Francis doesn't agree with this because the church's teaching is clear.
Well, let me ask you a follow-on to that, because I've recently been rereading Laudato Si, and one of the things that I'm getting from particularly the opening chapters of Laudato Si is this notion of God's extraordinary variety, that we are interdependent not simply on our fellow human beings, but on there being a multiplicity of various different types of life. And so if we apply that wisdom from Laudato Si back into our civic discourse, we're not trying to create monocultures. When we create monocultures, we create things that cannot be sustainable. We create cultures of death. Whereas when we actually allow for the flourishing of the kind of variety that you're talking about, including religious variety, all of our life, both our physical life, but also our civic life, is enhanced and becomes much more sustainable. Now, am I overplaying that connection? Or when I make that kind of parallel, does that sound right to you, Dan?
It does sound right to me. And I think it's interesting. I think you're doing a really interesting thing here in bridging the kind of human world to the more than human world, something Pope Francis himself does, famously borrowing from the phrase of the Franciscan theologian Leonardo Boff, hearing both the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor, or as Pope Francis says, everything is connected, this notion of an integral ecology. I think that's right. I think ecclesially, it's interesting to think about how we all bring something to the table. And certainly in the last 500 years, I might, as a Roman Catholic, look back over the so-called Protestant Reformation and the Counter-Reformation in the Roman tradition and see where things went awry because we were unwilling to hear in one another, to listen to one another on the other's terms rather than on our own kind of assumption of bad faith action. I would hope 500 years later that we have a different view. And what I mean by that is there are things that, for instance, Martin Luther was absolutely correct about that have been embraced and understood in the Roman tradition. And there are things that those who are in these Reformed traditions and not beyond the Lutheran Federation, the Radical Reform and so forth, can see value in the Roman tradition. And so I think in that regard, just ecumenically, there's a lot maybe we can draw from. But I think more fundamentally, what you're getting at too is if we think about this country in which we live, plurality, dialogue, difference, this is what makes us great, not what weakens us. And a kind of universal or ubiquitous understanding of one idiosyncratic interpretation of Christian life is dangerous for the reasons we've already outlined, but I think does weaken us as people of faith, but as a society that is just.
Well, I'll just jump in again and say, of course, that's true of our country. And I love, David, how you're reaching into Laudato Si to see how that can also be true for the whole earth. That said, such diversity and plurality is not easy. And I think while it might be a moral good for a number of reasons, I think it is can be a challenge. And I think we're in the middle of that challenge as a country, and we're in the middle of that challenge as a church. I know that in our next segment, Father Jim Martin will have something to say about how we're navigating that as a church as well. So I know we're going to return to these political conversations again in the future. You're listening to The Francis Effect. Thanks for being with us. Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm Heidi Schlumpf with today's guest, Father James Martin. Jim is a Jesuit priest, a prolific author, and editor-at-large at America Magazine. He's also the editor of Outreach, which is an online LGBTQ resource published by America Media. Jim has written about prayer, spirituality, and most recently about the story of Lazarus. If you haven't already checked out his latest book, it's called Come Forth, The Promise of Jesus's Greatest Miracle. Father Martin is, of course, best known as the former chaplain on the Colbert Report. Those were my favorite appearances. Much of Jim's work has focused on advocating for greater acceptance and inclusion of LGBTQ people in the church. I'll give another plug for his other book, Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. That's a good one. And Jim just returned from a month in Rome, where he served as a voting delegate at the Synod on Synodality. So welcome to the Francis Effect, Jim.
Thanks, Heidi, and it was nice to see you in Rome as well.
Right. So first, I'd like to ask you about the Synod on Synodality. While we were in Rome, you told me that so much of what made it a successful series of meetings was about the building of relationships. So could you say a little bit more about that and tell us, is that something that can be replicated or continued as the rest of us all move through this next year of synodality together?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for inviting me on the podcast. And at the beginning of our retreat, which was co-directed by Timothy Radcliffe and a woman named Mother Mary Ignatius, an Italian Benedictine sister, he talked about the purpose of the synod as building friendships. And it really struck me. He said, it may not make headlines, but this is what we're called to do. And he quoted St. John Paul II. I had never heard this quote. It's brilliant. He said, affective collegiality precedes effective collegiality, which I just loved. And so I thought, I don't know what I'm going to be able to do in this synod. I don't know what's going to happen. But I can certainly make friends and I can certainly try to build relationships. And yeah, I think it's really important in such a polarized church, not only worldwide, but in the United States. And we can talk about the method later that we did it in the Synod. But I really do think making friends and coming to know people from different cultures and certain very different perspectives, that's the first step, really. You can't, as Timothy Radcliffe said, you can't do anything without friendships. You just can't. You can't move ahead. So that for me framed my whole experience of the month over there.
And of course, at the end of this month-long summit, the Synod delegates, yourself included, voted on and released this document, the synthesis document. We're avoiding calling it a final document because it's just part of this process that continues. And it was supposed to summarize these areas of convergence, some questions for further exploration or study, and then it also made some recommendations. So I know you have already said publicly that you were not surprised, but maybe a little disappointed that so little was said in that document about the issue of LGBTQ Catholics. So what do you think that means, or how are you looking at that as we move forward in the process?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up, because a little bit of context is helpful, because I think, and I don't want to beat up on the media, who were beat up upon in the Synod regularly, and I would often remind people, hey, by the way, I'm in the media, because I think they did the best job that they could. But basically, what's important to know is that the LGBTQ issue was discussed, I would say, extensively in the Synod, at the tables without breaking confidence and at the plenary sessions. I can say that we discussed this topic. And there were really two ways of looking at it. One was my approach was that I think LGBTQ people need to be welcomed into the church, and the church needs to do more outreach, a little bit about kind of individuals. And then other groups or individuals who said that it was mainly a kind of result of an ideology and colonialism and those kinds of things, and really didn't like the term LGBTQ at all. So that was clear. That was certainly a divergence, I would say. In the final document, there are reflections of the different conversations that went along around different issues. So, for example, women deacons, lay participation, bishop authority, all those kinds of things. They were pretty well reflected in the final document. But what happened was, because of a lot of opposition to even the term LGBTQ, the writers felt that in order to get a paragraph through that talked about reaching out to people on the margins, they couldn't use that term. They really had to downplay the discussion. And so that's what happened. In order to sort of put this paragraph in, or two paragraphs in, I think it's in section 15 or 16, that talk about accompanying people, they had to really water it down. So I was disappointed, because that term, and you know, I don't want to get so hung up on the term, but the you know, names are important and terms are important. That term, which was in the working document, the Instrumentum Laboris, and which we used, you know, around the tables, did not make it into the final synthesis. So I was disappointed. But after a day or so, I realized, well, there's a lot in that those two paragraphs that talk about, in the Italian, it actually says sexual orientation and gender identity, which was a surprise to me. So I think there's still a lot in there. We're only halfway through. And I knew what the synod was for. I didn't expect any church teaching to change or any big decision to come of this. So I want to make that clear too, that the synod is consultative. It's not some juridical body. But yeah, I was disappointed, but I'm very hopeful. And there are so many people who were positive about LGBTQ people and coming up to me and saying, thanks for your work and help me in my diocese. But there's a lot of opposition to that, as we know, in the church. And frankly, as it was good to see it being revealed. So we have a lot of work to do. But I think the door is still open for further discussion for the next synod.
Well, speaking of further discussion, the other issue that a lot of our listeners I know care about is the issue of women's leadership in the church, and particularly the possible expansion of roles in ordination. Mostly, I think what was spoken about was to the diaconate, not so much to the priesthood. And the synthesis document put that in the further study category, although it had more to say about it than about LGBTQ issues. So some of the advocates I've spoken to were happy that it was discussed at the synod and that it's still on the table for discussion. Although I think some people were hoping for something stronger, maybe a recommendation. Is there anything, again, I know you're held to confidence, but is there anything that you can share about where that might be going forward?
Yeah, I think the synod document, the synthesis document, did a good job of reflecting the reality of the conversations. It was discussed also extensively. It was discussed in a very direct way. It wasn't women's leadership roles. It was women's ordination to the diaconate. It wasn't as usual. Sometimes in these meetings, I've not been to a synod before, but it's skirted and they talk about leadership roles and they don't bring up the O word, ordination. But it was pretty clear what people were talking about. People were pretty forceful about it. And I thought the document was really fair about our conclusions. And look, here's a document that passed with sort of recommendation for further study in women's ordination. And that's the whole synod. That's people from all over the world. So I thought that was, I think Cardinal Hollerich said that. That's extraordinary. I think one of the most interesting parts was, as you know, there have been two official papal commissions, one of them with our friend Phyllis Agana, who's pretty much the world's expert on women deacons, and another more recent one. But the results have never been published. And the synod asked Pope Francis for the results of those commissions, I love this, if possible, which is trying to be polite. So I think that's the idea. The idea is further study. There's certainly an interest in there. And I think I can say what I was most surprised about in that conversation was the directness with which people spoke about it, right? It was not about women's leadership roles. It was about that as well, which I think everybody was on board with that. It was about women's ordination to the diaconate. I think the other interesting thing that came up for me, and this is in the document too, so this is not breaking confidence, was to look at the diaconal ministry overall. There was some concern among synod members that the ministry of the diaconate is being seen as only a liturgical ministry when it should be seen as a ministry of charity. Diaconia means service. That was really interesting because that went in a direction that I couldn't have predicted. So not just women as deacons, but what does the diaconate mean in general? So you had some really thoughtful people around there, and it was just interesting to hear the conversations, like things that you would never kind of think of. So anyway, yes, but much more positive about that than LGBT stuff.
I know that for many people, your ministry in support of LGBTQ Catholics has really been appreciated, but it's also brought a lot of negative pushback, sometimes directed at you personally. How do you handle those attacks? What do you think? Does it say something broader about polarization in our society, or do you just have thick skin? How do you handle all that?
How do I deal with it? Well, the first thing is to recognize that not everybody's going to like me. That's the most important thing. Not everyone's going to like me, love me, or approve of me. That's number one. Second, that Jesus is our model, and Jesus went through this when he was standing with people on the margins. He promised people who follow him pushback, so that's not surprising. I have a thick skin when it's someone who I don't know.
Mm.
If it's some random person on the street who I don't know, or some bishop that I've never met, that's one thing. If it's someone who I know and I admire and I trust, if the attacks came from that, it would be more disturbing. But it's time consuming. It's not the most a wonderful thing to happen when you're walking back after a long day to be attacked on the street. But look, it's part of the ministry. And the other thing is this. I met people there from Myanmar, from Sudan, from East Timor, from Hong Kong, from mainland China. There's all sorts of persecution going on. So I'm not the only one who struggles.
Well, much of your ministry, and some of these are probably people you don't know, is carried out on social media. You have, I think, over millions of followers if you put all your social media accounts together. Why do you think that's important for you to have that presence there? Some people have given up or describe it as a cesspool of negativity. Why do you have such a presence there? What do you think you can accomplish as a priest and an advocate?
Well, that's a great question. There was a lot of talk at the Synod about, I'm not sure if I like this term or not, the digital continent. So there were there was back and forth about, should we call it a digital continent, or is it really actually, it's part of all of our lives, and to segregate it doesn't make a lot of sense. But there's a pretty simple answer, because that's where people are. And that's where a lot of people get their news. I was really surprised that when I posted, now we weren't allowed to really share too much of what was going on in the Synod, I've not talked about different individual interventions and actual kind of conversations, other than in the most general way. But so I figured I would start putting up pictures like, this is what the Allah looks like. This is my group. This is where we are. I was really surprised at the number of people who said, thank you so much. This makes me feel like I'm there. It's really helpful. And I thought, boy, that's really interesting, because it's just pictures, right? And I'm not really saying very much. But I think people want to feel a part of it. They should feel a part of it, because this is their synod too.
Hey, well, speaking of young people who are on social media, for sure, I think a number of them are frustrated, especially here in the U.S., with how the church treats LGBTQ people. And then there's this whole trend of them disassociating with the institutional church. What do you say to those young people? That seems to be a big issue that we're facing here in the U.S.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think the new category, we had the nuns, people who weren't affiliated. Now we have the duns, which they're just done with church. They don't need it. At first, I listen to them and I try to hear where they are. A lot of it's LGBTQ people themselves, but also family members, people who are maybe disgusted with something that a church leader says. But I often try to remind people, look, you're part of this church. You're baptized. And you're as much a part of the church as the Pope, your local bishop, me, your pastor, anyone who says that you're a bad Catholic or whatever. And so I remind people that this is their church and they're rooted and grounded in it through baptism. And this is the church that we're in right now. And can you help make it better and more welcoming and more of a home for LGBTQ people? I really believe that as more and more people come out, the church will become more and more open. I really do believe that.
What can everyday Catholics do to help facilitate this and move this along? If you said the change you hope to see is for people to be recognized and listened to, that seems like a start. But is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners that they could do?
Yeah, I would say on the local level, listen to your LGBTQ friends, welcome them, be friends with them, of course, But I think the other step is to really advocate for them, right? To advocate for them in your parishes, if there are places where you feel that the parish could be more welcoming, or school or neighborhood that can be more welcoming, stand up for them. And it can get you some pushback. I often use the story of Zacchaeus. And Zacchaeus is the man who has little stature. He's short. And LGBTQ people have little stature too, right, in the church. They can't see Jesus because of the crowd, right, like in the Luke story. And when Zacchaeus comes down from that tree after Jesus calls him, one of my favorite lines is, all who saw this began to grumble. And that's what happens in the church today. So to be ready for the grumbling and not to let it dissuade you when you're advocating for these people who are really on the margins. So I think really taking up their cause and casting your lot with them and not being afraid of the grumbling. It happened in Jesus' time. It happens in our time. So why should we be afraid?
Well, thank you so much, Jim, for sharing with our listeners some of your reflections about the Synod and about LGBTQ ministry. I'll just remind people again that your new book, Out, Come Forth, is really great. I've started it. I haven't finished it yet, but it's a favorite story of mine from Scripture, so I'm enjoying your deep dive into it. Is there anything else that you'd like to share before we go?
Yeah, I'll tell you a funny story. So we had interventions, meaning we could speak to the plenary session for 3 minutes apiece. And I was teasing with some of the people at my table that I was going to say, the Synod really is an experience of the church looking at things that it needs to let die, needs to let go of, needs to leave behind in the tomb, and really hear God's voice asking it to come forth. Something like my new book, Come Forth, The Story of Jesus' Greatest Miracle. And they all laughed. They said, I dare you to do an ad for your book and your intention. I decided not to. But yeah, I do want to say, since you know you brought it up, the book is out. It's really special to me. And it is about how God calls all of us forth to new life and to leave behind things that keep us bound. And I'm teasing about it, but that really is also what the church is called to do during the Synod, to leave things behind and move into the light. So hopefully the story of Lazarus can be helpful for the church, but also for all of us individually.
Thank you again, Father Jim Martin, for joining us here on The Francis Effect.
My pleasure. Thanks for a great podcast, and thanks for all the great good you do at NCR.
Hello, this is David again. The full version of Heidi's interview is available on our Patreon site, patreon.com/FrancisFXPod. Listeners, also in the midst of this, as we're recording, some tragic news just came through. And Dan, I wonder if you'd be willing to speak to that for just a moment.
Yeah, so those who are familiar with the Catholic theological world, especially those who are watchers of the church, would be familiar or have heard of the American theologian, Dr. Richard Gagliardi, who in the last number of years was a professor and even department chair at Boston College, wrote a lot about church authority, about theology of holy orders, about communion in the church, was really one of the leading experts on ecclesiology. He's been struggling for the last number of years fighting cancer, and we just learned from a number of colleagues, theological colleagues, that as we Franciscans say, he embraced our sister bodily death. This was imminent. Those of us who know Rick and know his family and who have been following these last several months, especially in these last few days, knew that this was imminent and something that he himself was preparing for. Deeply a man of prayer, somebody who was very reflective, even though suffering through tremendous pain and this illness. One of the things that I found particularly moving is he was a big fan of the Texas Rangers, and with his four sons and wife with him, was able to learn that the Texas Rangers won the World Series in these last days. And so that brings me just a little bit of a smile in what is certainly a difficult time for those who are close to him. Rick was one of my professors when I was in doctoral studies, and somebody who was, just left a very important legacy in terms of theological work, especially as we think about the church. So I know we join his family and loved ones in the theologian community as we mourn the earthly loss of Rick's presence, but are grateful for the scholarship and the work and the collegiality and friendships that he formed over many decades of doing important work with and on behalf of the church that will stay with us.
For Heidi and Father Dan, I'm David Dalt. We'll be back in a couple weeks with the next episode of the Francis Effect podcast. Thank you so much for listening. The Francis Effect is produced by Sandberg Media LLC and is recorded remotely in Chicago, Illinois and South Bend, Indiana. It's edited by me at the William Adams Studios in Hyde Park on Chicago's beautiful South Side. The opinions of this program are our own and do not reflect the positions of any organizations with which we may be affiliated. We want to give a shout out to the Salt and Light Catholic Media Foundation. They are not affiliated with our program, but they did give us their kind permission to use the name The Francis Effect, and we appreciate it very much. Please check out their good work at slmedia.org. This show is made possible in part by our Patreon supporters, and if you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/francisfxpod. We appreciate it very much. Please follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Both of those are at francisfxpod, and our website is also francisfxpod.com. Please tell your friends about the show, and if you're here for the first time, we have seasons and seasons of episodes that you can go back to and listen to for your heart's content. We're so glad that you're here. Heidi and Father Daniel and I will be back in about 2 weeks. We're looking forward to being with you then. Thank you again for listening.